time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for September 1st, 2018. It's our Labor Day weekend here in the States, and I hope everyone is out riding safely today, as well as having fun with an extra day off. September is, for me, the psychological beginning of the fall cycling season, just as March 1st is always the beginning of the spring cycling season. With the shorter days, out come the lights and fenders, and it's off to ride in cooler weather. Many folks find fall riding their very favorite and often flock to all those places that experience the magnificence of the trees offering their spectacular colors for our enjoyment. It's also time for jackets, arm warmers, leg warmers, and other cool riding gear, and we're going to be bringing you a show about that pretty soon. Tonight, however, we're speaking with two very interesting people. First up is Lisa Mazzola. When I first learned about her, from a listener, by the way, I thought, how is it possible that she's an artist, a yoga instructor, and a bicycling coach, and I don't know her? Well, I do now, and I think you'll like her a lot. She lives in New York City, and along with her partner, Kristen Phillips, run the Art of Cycling NYC. They incorporate the mindfulness of yoga with the focus of skills training in all the areas of cycling that might not come naturally to some of us. Lisa and Kristen have developed some great programs for their clients. Lisa will be with me in a moment. Then after a break, we'll welcome Peter Cozens back to the show. Last year, we spoke to Peter about his book, The First Tour de France. This year, his new book, How the Race Was Won, is a study in tactics. From the earliest tour in 1903 to modern-day racing, Peter looks back in history and follows the development of tactics right up to today. What he finds is fascinating and informative. How the Race Was Won might just be the book you would like to add to your holiday gift, but you're going to have to wait. It won't be out till November 12th. This is a sneak peek. So it's off to New York City first to speak with Lisa Mazzola about the Art of Cycling NYC. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, it's going to be fun because you and I seem to have a lot in common. Cycling, art, and yoga. It's like it doesn't get a little more close to my life, except maybe we went down different paths in each of those things.
Sounds good, yeah.
Could you give us a bit of background on you and those three things especially, and maybe start with the one that's, I don't want to say nearest and dearest to your heart, because I know that they all sort of interconnect and they all mean a lot to you.
Sure. Maybe I'll start chronologically with the art piece. I grew up having an appreciation for art at a very young age. I can remember when I was 13, 14 years old, going to flea markets and always being fascinated by all the art that I saw at the different poster shops. And I would flip through the bins and I would look at all the different artists. And at some point, I think I was about 14 when my mother took me to the Metropolitan Museum of Art for the first time. And that really had a huge impact on me. And I actually proclaimed that someday I was going to work at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which, you know, is funny to me now as an adult, because I do work in a museum. I don't work at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, but I work at a museum, the Museum of Modern Art, which is often mistaken for the Metropolitan Museum of Art on a regular basis. So that was kind of interesting. And for me, you know, my interest in art has expanded to the work that I do in art education, specifically working with the K-12 audience, working with teachers, working with schools, and really helping teachers and students connect with works of art to kind of see the connections between themselves, between big ideas in the world. So, you know, art is really a powerful tool for change. And so it's been great to spend all these years being in the art world and really engaging with it with different people in different ways. So that's sort of the art piece that's ongoing. And then the yoga piece probably comes next. When I moved to New York City in 1998, I became very deeply connected with the yoga community here through a friend who had been telling me about a yoga studio, a local studio that then went on to be, you know, hugely successful. But at the time, it was a very small studio. It was right in my neighborhood. And I seemed to connect pretty quickly with the community there. And for me, that was the first form of, I want to say, physical kind of practice that I found to be the most impactful for me. It was very meditative and it allowed me to kind of experience my physical body in different ways. And it so inspired me that eventually I decided that I wanted to teach yoga. And I did that for several years and took a little bit of a hiatus and now I'm back at it. But over the years, my yoga practice has always been with me in different ways. And that kind of brings me to cycling, which is that my yoga practice has become very specific to both the work I do as a coach, but also personally as an athlete, personally as a cyclist, because it is such an incredibly powerful tool, not only for its restorative abilities and for athletic recovery, but the kind of balance and focus that you need in a yoga class, to me, is the exact balance and focus and attention that we should have on the bike in whatever discipline that we practice in cycling. So yeah, so that's my cycling art and yoga story.
It's a good story. I like it a lot. It's very dissimilar to my story. Mine was much more disjointed, except for the cycling and yoga. They've always sort of been together, cycling first and then yoga. So you mentioned that you grew up loving art. And so you're an art educator. What are you doing at the museum exactly? And this is the Museum of Modern Art, not the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which I know that people do get those confused. We have a Cleveland Museum of Art, and then we have our Museum of Modern Art here, too.
Yes, yes. And it's a totally understandable confusion, so I don't blame anybody for that. But yes, I've been at the Museum of Modern Art as the Assistant Director of School and Teacher Programs for 13 years. And my role has pretty much always been in the area of developing programs and resources for K-12 primary, secondary teachers, students. So I work in very large part with teachers and administrators. And then I have staff that work with me on developing our school visits and our school partnership programs. So we do programs on site here at the museum. We also do programs in schools. And a sort of third component that has evolved over the last 13 years as technologies have evolved is that I also work on these digital projects. We have a website called MoMA Learning. I also do these MOOCs, these massive open online courses on how our museum-based teaching strategies can be used in the classroom. So it's a lot about inquiry and how we can use inquiry and artworks to connect to other areas of content in the classroom.
Very, very interesting stuff. Very. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Lisa Mazzola. She is in New York. We are going to actually switch gears from the art museum and talk about how art gets integrated into something else she's doing. It's called The Art of Cycling NYC, New York City. What is the concept? And then we'll kind of break it down and talk about who participates in it.
Yeah. So Art of Cycling NYC was founded by myself and my partner, Kristen Phillips, in 2016. We were both cycling coaches who, you know, very similar to the conversation you and I happened when we met while cycling. We realized that we had these three common intersections, cycling, art, and yoga. And we actually entered into this kind of lengthy conversation straight away about the ways that we saw the impact of art process and art making and yoga and cycling, in that We often talk about this in the art world and the yoga world, and I think it's less so talked about in the cycling world, is that it really, we tend to be results oriented on the bike, which is a great thing. We want to have our goals in place, but there is so much process that happens that's integral to getting you to that goal. So, you know, and I think I speak for a lot of people, and it's always interesting to me whenever you hear, you know, frequently you'll hear professional cyclists talk about this, you know, that their favorite part is the training. They like the racing. But I think, you know, Kristen and I really agreed that it's so important to be as present as we can, as mindful as we can in our journey to that end result. So that's kind of the philosophical underpinnings of Art of Cycling NYC. And in practical terms, we are a full service coaching business. You know, we work with individual athletes. We do indoor group sessions with athletes. We do yoga for cyclists. We have a very active blog that we write and publish on, where we talk about topics that are important to us and that we think are hopefully helpful for others. So that's really kind of, I think, gives you a sense of kind of where we're coming from.
Well, I know one of the sections of your blog that interests me especially is skills, because I think that a lot of people forget that you just don't hop on a bike and get out there and not have skills. And I think you probably found out more about the skills when you started mountain biking, because I know mountain bikers fall down a lot. You were a road racer or a road rider for sure, and have recently gotten into mountain biking. Is that what I understand?
Yes. 2 years ago, which I think is still pretty recent, I, through the influence of my partner, Kristen Phillips, who is a very experienced former elite pro holding licensed mountain bike racer, she really introduced me to the sport. I had done it maybe once or twice, and then she introduced me to mountain biking. And, you know, I started this journey 2 years ago, but I have to say, when it comes to skills, there's absolutely so much skill on the road. So I would say it's equal amount of skill that you have to learn. I think with mountain biking, it's just super, super specific skill, in that obviously the terrain can be very technical, very varied. So there's always kind of something new coming at you, which is a little bit different than the road. But it's interesting to me, now that I look back on my own journey as a road cyclist, I sort of took to the road skills pretty quickly, but really it's very challenging when you think about it. And that's why I love teaching skills so much, because it is so hard for people who have not grown up on a bike. I mean, it was hard for me because I didn't grow up on a mountain bike. I did grow up riding my bike around my neighborhood, so that was not a stretch. But I think for most people, you know, road cycling and mountain biking, they're intimidating. And if you're going to be an endurance cyclist, or even think about racing, or want to do anything more technical, there's a lot of skill that you have to learn.
And I think that when we are out on the road, the people who do not have the skills to handle a bike are the ones who scare the hell out of me, really.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. Let me ask, you know what, before I want to ask you about yoga, we're going to take a real short break. Can you hang with me and we'll be right back?
Sure thing.
Okay. I'm speaking with Lisa Mazzola from The Art of Cycling NYC. We will be right back. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back, and if you are just joining me, we're speaking with Lisa Mazzola. She is one of the two partners at Art of Cycling NYC in, obviously, New York City. Because of our backgrounds, our mutual backgrounds in yoga, I've always said, and this may or may not rub your fur the wrong way, I've always said that I don't really believe in cycling for anything specific. I think cycling is for every body, not meaning everybody, but everybody. So tell me how you tailor your yoga for cyclists. Obviously, a lot of my clients are cyclists and a lot of them are not. I actually tailor my practiced for seniors more than for cyclists. But I just would like to hear what you say about yoga for cyclists that maybe I'm missing.
So, you know, I think there's kind of two ways that I look at it. So one would probably be sort of a 30,000 feet look down or sort of a kind of philosophical approach, which is that there is a certain mindset as a yoga practitioner, a student of yoga, or that we all should have, or that we're sort of expected to have. So, for example, you enter into a yoga class. It's this idea that we're there to be grounded and connect with our bodies in a more united way, right? So that, you know, it's very easy in our everyday that we're running around and we're all over the place. And so we're really drawing our energy and our focus a little bit more inward, and we're really striving to kind of unite the sort of mind, body, spirit. That overall, I think, is absolutely relevant to cycling. When you're on a bike, I think most of us would probably admit, us obsessive cyclists, that one of the things we love about it so much is how in the moment we become. And on one level, I think that's just pure joy, which is so incredible to me. And I'm so grateful that it exists in my life, that I can find that connected moment, even with other things going on in my life that may not feel so joyful or so connected or so positive. But there's also a very practical application of that, which is that, you know, we need, it could be a dangerous sport if we're not paying attention, if we're not grounded, if we're not centered, because there are things that we encounter out on the road that we have to be careful of, whether it's a pothole in the road or traffic, or, you know, just over the weekend, we ran into a timber rattlesnake mountain biking. So, you know, it really requires that kind of attention. So I think that's one way that cycling and yoga is very much this that is very connected. And then the other piece of it is looking at cyclists, and I mean all cyclists, recreational cyclists, competitive cyclists. There is an amount of restorative and strengthening that happens from the physical postures and also some of the other elements of the practice, whether it's pranayama and breathing technique, flexibility. So I think one of the areas that often I find that cyclists can sometimes be a little bit deficient in is some of that very functional core stability and strength that they need in order to quite literally maintain, you know, the various postures that you have to on the bike. So I think that it physically is a great complement to cycling. Again, whether you're doing it in a structured or purely recreational, yet maybe structured. So in whatever way or to whatever level, I think that there are amazing things that you can get out of, as an example, you know, yoga for athletic recovery is something that I'm really interested in. And I think that just like you would in cycling periodize your training based on where you are in the season, I think that our yoga practice can change and be periodized to address and complement your cycling season, depending on what your goals are.
Very interesting perspective. I appreciate it. And of course, a lot of what you said is sort of what the practice is, regardless of what you're doing outside of the practice. But I can see how you're approaching it. And I like it. I think it's very well thought out and will be successful. So a lot of yoga for me, you can tell when somebody is not there for the practice. You know, they'll come in and they say, I'm here to stretch. And then you kind of wonder how you can bring them into the holistic view of yoga, which is more than, it's a little more than stretching, we hope. So yeah, it's excellent. I like that. Thanks. I appreciate you saying that. Thanks. I also was wondering about the coaching that you do. And maybe this is just what I'm gleaning. You only coach women or do you coach men too?
No, we coach men and women.
Okay, good. Because I didn't get that out of the website. So who is your typical client? Who is your coaching student?
You know, we actually have a pretty varied, just like the sport of cycling, which I think it's so amazing how many different types of people outside of the bike that it brings. We have a pretty varied clientele, people who work with us. I mean, just as an example, this season, I worked with men and women who had, you know, very specific goals, like a half Ironman, and a gal who was so new to road cycling. She wasn't super new to road cycling, but she was terribly afraid at riding with foot retention, and she didn't know how to fuel both eating and drinking on the bike. To another athlete that I work with who was a cyclist who wanted to try racing and was starting her first sort of full-time season racing. So, you know, we kind of run the gamut of people who have very specific fitness goals that may not be in competition, to people who do have very specific competition goals. And I would say that the range of age of our clientele this past year was from 25 to 65.
Nice. That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah.
What does group coaching look like?
So we do every season, generally in the winter months. So the past 2 years, we've kicked it off in January, and we do 3 months of indoor CompuTrainer classes.
Uh-huh.
But the way that ours work are different than typical CompuTrainer classes in that we're actually teaching on the bike skills while we're teaching those classes. So we co-teach the classes so that it's two coaches on site. And we developed the curriculum around specific themes. One example was we had an indoor climbing camp. So it was developing form and fitness specifically for climbing. And so in that instance, although obviously people are executing workouts that we create, we are spending the first 15 minutes or say 10 minutes to 15 minutes of each class doing a lecture format that often included slides and video to cover the specific topics that we were going to go through over the 4 weeks. So for us, it was really important in the wintertime to not only, people tend to focus on, well, I want to stay fit over the winter, but there's all this work that we need to do that's very core to the practice and to the process of cycling around form and technique and also mindset. So that's where we came up with this type of class that we teach. And so the past two seasons, we've done this class specifically around climbing, and then another class where we focus on training with metrics and really demystifying for people how you can train with heart rate, because we do use CompuTrainers. We can talk about power, but in general, the only requirement for that is for people to have a heart rate monitor. And there's so many people that don't really understand that there is a specificity to training, and it's actually not super, super complicated if you want to start to enter into that. And also, you know, looking at the basic skills of cadence and all that type of stuff, and also making sure that people know that they can practice how to ride successfully indoors, you know, not just outdoors. Because often, you know, over the winter, that is that time where people, you know, even if they know all of the techniques and all of the form, I think it's really helpful for people to be in a class where they're being watched, and we are the gentle, watchful eye to just help them and guide them over the course of these classes that we do that are usually in four-week sessions.
People need to be there to do your sessions. You're not doing things virtually.
Yes.
Okay.
We've dabbled with a little bit of virtual stuff. My partner, Kristen, has led a couple of rides in Zwift. We have not fully launched in the virtual world. Currently, these are in-person classes.
Yeah. Makes more sense, right? I mean, you need to really see somebody.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I think there's all this really interesting stuff happening in virtual and in these online training platforms. I think they're all really great tools. And I'm so happy it really broadens people's ability to not be tortured riding inside. But for me, I mean, personally, and it's funny because I do online education in the museum world, and that has become hugely successful. But, you know, I always love being with people. I love the interaction with people. It brings me, you know, enjoyment and fulfillment that way. That will always be what I would probably prefer, although, you know, who knows what will happen in the future.
Right, right. That is so true. Okay, one of the things I do want to talk about is whether you're continually developing new programs and expanding the ones you have. So do you have some new plans for 2019 that aren't appearing yet on your website, which we will tell people how to find out about you, and read your blog, which has tons of great information?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we, you know, one of the things that we've talked about you know, we didn't know how successful the indoor classes would be. So we're absolutely going to expand those. More on that TBD, but we're getting very close to getting that information out there. It won't be altogether different, but we just realized that that format works, so that we're going to, you know, expand our offerings in 2019, late 2018 for the indoor classes. In regard to the blog, the writing is something that we're both really, really interested in. And I think that we are just going to continue to really expand on the blog. I mean, we're very consistent about the posting because we both have things that we really want to write about. But as one example, I know that I'm really interested in the sort of mental side of training. You know, recently Kristen posted a little bit about nutrition. We have a lot of plans to continue to do all this research and do all this self-study that we do and find the ways that we can pull things into Artist Cycling NYC and just bring more resources. I mean, there's a lot of professionals out there, which is amazing. And I think we just want to continue to share all the good research and all the good content sort of we find and kind of curate for people, the best of the best, you know, that covers all the different areas, whether it's on mindfulness or nutrition or, you know, obviously training. So I think that will happen. And I think the other piece is just really continuing to do the work we do with skills. We also have a program where we mentor women cyclists in a local program that Kristen started. So, you know, I think that those things will just continue to evolve and you know, continue down the path. They're already on a good path, but I'm excited to continue to do that kind of work. I just loved this season seeing so many cyclists blossom into confident riders. And, you know, that's really something that makes us both personally happy and we feel like we're accomplishing something when we can do that.
I wanted to ask you a couple of personal questions, if you don't mind. What do you do when you're not doing these three other things, yoga, cycling, and art? Do you actually have a life?
I do. I mean, they take up a lot of my life.
Yeah,
but,
no kidding.
I do love to travel. And it's great that I can incorporate cycling and travel. I was just in the Pyrenees riding and shadowing and watching stages of the Tour de France. But I also love to just travel and do non-cycling things. I love exploring the food and culture of other countries, of other cities. That's always been something that's been really a big part of my life. So I continue to do that. And then in my own little world in New York City, I have my two adorable cats that I love more than anything. And I love when I have downtime to just read and have them both in a ball on either side of me.
Well, you answered one of my, you know, end of interview questions early, but that's okay. That's okay. I mean, you know, it got in there when it got in there. So I have been speaking with Lisa Mazzola from Art of Cycling NYC. As usual, I ask my three questions at the end of a personal interview, which I would consider this a personal interview as opposed to a product review, right? And you've already answered one, but what's your favorite food?
Any vegetable possible and coffee.
Not necessarily in that order. What music do you listen to or do you like?
Depends what I'm doing. High energy for training, chill and relaxed for quiet home time.
Yeah, sure. And of course, we already know you have two cats. So, all right. So since we know you have them and I can't say, do you have any pets? What are their names? Might as well go there, right?
Yes. One of my cats is Ollie and the other is Estella.
I love it. Well, you know, everybody knows that these shows are recorded. And I just asked my friend who was on a trip to the Pyrenees. When did you go? Where were you?
I was staying very close. The closest town to where I was saying, people know Bagnères de Luchon, but Campagne Sainte-Marie. So basically the bottom of Tourmalet, of Col de Tourmalet, there's on one side is Campagne Sainte-Marie. And I was staying like, you know, less than 5 kilometers from that little town, maybe closer to like 3 kilometers. And I was there in July, the third week of the tour, during the Tour de France High Mountain Stage in the Pyrenees.
Yeah, all right. He went later. Okay, I was just wondering. He's just a really good friend, and he just did a whole bunch of those mountains and coals and sent back all kinds of stuff about how hard it was, how hard it was.
It's amazing. It's really challenging. This is my second trip there, and I've also done the Alps, and, you know, it's really, there's nothing like it. I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing, and it's definitely intense.
What kind of bike do you ride?
So the road bike that I'm riding right now is a Specialized Amira.
Okay.
And my mountain bike is a Trek Top Fuel.
Well, there you go. There you have it. The two big brands right now, T&S, right?
Yep.
Yep. Well, Lisa, this has been a wonderful conversation. I really appreciate you taking time. I will catch up with Kristen at some point so we can get the other half of Art of Cycling NYC. Thank you so much. Tell our listeners how they can find out more about you, your coaching, and all of the things that you do. And especially if they're in New York City, they can maybe, let people just drop in and find out about you? I don't know where you're located, actually.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm New York City. I live in Manhattan. My partner, Kristen, lives in Brooklyn. And yeah, if someone's coming through town and, you know, they want to do a one-on-one skill session, they absolutely can reach us. If you just go to artistcyclingnyc.com, we have all of our information on the website, including how you can get a hold of us. You can also follow us on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. Instagram is probably, I think, you know, seems to be the place that everyone seems to go now. So definitely check us out there. And that's just Art of Cycling NYC. But yeah, if you're going to be in town and you want or need skills instruction or our services, we are here for you.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me. I really appreciate it. I hope you have a wonderful day. And we'll maybe talk again. When I come to New York, I'll look you up.
Absolutely. It was great talking to you, Diane.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
You too.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Lisa Mazzola joined me from her office in New York City. If you're interested in Lisa and Kristen's work, you can log on to theartofcyclingnyc.com and check out their blog, the training programs, and a host of other interesting things. So let's take a short break, and when we return, we're going to go to France to speak with author Peter Cozens about his new book, How the Race Was Won.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU University Heights.
So we're back. I'm Diane Jenks, and you are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. If you think that race tactics are about sprinting, falling off the back, or breaking away, you're missing a big chunk. There's also dirty dealing, bluffing, and dealing with chaos. It's all part of Peter Cozens' new book, How the Race Was Won. Peter, who lives in France, has some fascinating things to say about the current state of racing, including how more exciting and unpredictable women's racing is today. So let's head on over to France for a chat with Peter. Hi, Peter. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. It's nice to talk with you again.
It's nice to be back, Diane. Good to talk to you.
Thanks for joining me. You have a new book.
I do have a new book, yes.
It's good, except it's not really available yet. So this is sort of a sneak peek for our listeners. And hopefully they'll put it on their want list for the holidays, if not before. How the Race Was Won, Cycling's Top Minds Reveal the Road to Victory. It's really interesting. It's got a lot of history. It's got a lot of current stuff going on. And it'll be available November 12th here in the States.
That's right. Yeah. It's already available in the UK and Europe, but the States is taking a little bit longer.
Yeah. Why is that? Why is it already out there and not here?
I think just because they kind of wanted to rewrite a few bits and maybe maybe they wanted to release it just before Christmas because it was the sales are better there. I don't honestly know. There doesn't seem to be any great reason for it, but that's just the way it's turned out.
There is no great reason. I get it. Okay, fine. So let's talk a little bit about this book. And now you're in, where are you? Are you in England?
I'm in France. I'm in the French Pyrenees. I live, if you remember last year's Tour de France, there was a very short stage in the Pyrenees, 100 kilometers into Foix, which Warren Barguil won on Bastille Day. And I live about 6 kilometers from the finish of that stage.
You know what? I remember talking about that. I do, that you were really excited because it was coming right through where you live.
That's right. It went right through our village.
That's so
it
cool. It must have been crazy.
Yeah, it was a really great day. I mean, I was actually up on the last climb watching them come through there, so I wasn't in the village, but it was a fantastic day. I mean, helped by the fact that it was Bastille Day, French national holiday. A Frenchman won, so everybody was happy, basically.
Yeah, right. I guess so. So let's talk a little bit about your new book. How did you decide to do one on tactics, which is really what it's about, and tactics in the old days, tactics today, which are very different?
Yeah, I mean, it came about because I was actually reading a book on football or soccer, as you'd call it, called Inverting the Pyramid, which is like a history of tactics in soccer since the 19th century. And it just sort of struck me quite early on. I thought, well, I'd never read a book about this in cycling. This is a really interesting subject. Nobody really talks about this. And I sort of looked around, and there are one or two books that people have done on kind of specific, almost like manuals that you can buy to train yourself on tactics if you're a racer. But if you're a fan looking in and want to know about tactics, there's nothing at all. So it struck me that, well, first of all, it was an interesting topic, and then nobody had written about it. So it made for a good subject for a book.
How long did it take you to write it?
I guess probably, given all the research I did, probably the best part of a year, at least nine months to a year.
And here we are birthing a new book. That's so cool. So
that's right.
When you went back in history and looked at some of the old tactics, obviously you couldn't talk with riders from them. And we do have riders today that and teams and directeur sportif and all kinds of people with whom you can speak today. But let's go back in history, explain the development of tactics, what that looked like in the early days.
Well, to start with, I mean, probably the first reference point is a book written by Henri Desgrange, who people might know as the founder of the Tour de France. He was the editor of L'Auto magazine that founded the Tour de France in 1903. And he wrote a book, a manual on tactics, in 1894 called La Tête et les Jambes, The Head and the Legs. And basically, it's written by Desgrange almost as a kind of a guidebook to his 15-year-old self. He's writing as this older coach, sort of guiding this 15-year-old boy who's also himself, effectively, when he was younger, and sort of giving him the advice that he didn't have when he was 15-year-old, the stuff that he didn't know, guiding him through. And this kind of became a manual, I guess, for a lot of riders at that time. And the key thing for Desgrange, as the title says, was that tactics is all about having strong legs, but it's also being clever in the head as well. So you might have the strongest legs, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to win a bike race. If you're strong in the head, if you're clever, you can outwit people who are stronger than you. I mean, he obviously went on to found the Tour, and tactics initially were pretty basic. I mean, it was the Tour and other races were very much races of endurance in terms of not only for the riders, but for their equipment. And so often they were decided by bikes failing, by riders sort of falling by the wayside when they were riding stages of 400 and 500 kilometres in all kinds of conditions. So they were pretty basic. I mean, it took quite a long time for concepts like the peloton to develop. Riders didn't really ride in a group for a long time. They just sort of raced from the off. And even longer for things like lead-out trains, for sprinters to develop. I mean, descents weren't really a big kind of tactical issue back in those early days. You just kind of survived down to descent. You didn't really take risks on them. And so the sports kind of evolved quite slowly, but not massively. I mean, there's not been the same technical or tactical development that has in probably, in soccer or, I know, American football, I would imagine, where tactics have changed quite radically over the last century or so. Cycling, it's been much slower, and essentially a lot of the tactics are pretty much the same. They're just kind of, they've been tweaked over the decades.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Peter Kozins. He has written a new book, How the Race Was Won, Cycling's Brightest Minds Share Their Race Strategies. And we will talk about a couple of the brightest minds with whom Peter spoke. We recently reviewed a book called Comeback by Daniel DeVries, and it's a story about Greg LeMond. And one of the things that was brought out in this book, and I think everybody knows it, is the deal that was made between LeMond and Hinault that was a broken deal. Dirty tactics or dirty dealing. You actually have a chapter about dirty dealing. Tell us a little bit about that. It's an interesting one.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been part of it. That's one of the things that happens very much in cycling, enduring races, even now. I mean, you, if you think about it, even now, riders will be, even though they're not making a deal, they're kind of making a tactical deal with other riders because they've got shared interests. So if you're in a breakaway group with, I don't know, six other riders, you kind of have a common interest in trying to keep that breakaway away. But at a certain point, you've got to break that deal with those other six guys because you want to win. You want to outwit them. So that deal then comes to an end. And that kind of dealing is going on all the time. And with an incident like Le Mans and Eno in 85 and 86, where they were actually kind of bargaining with each other about who was going to win which tour and how it was going to be done. That was, that was interesting to watch and be aware of. But, I mean, a lot of the dealing that went on was actually the buying and selling of races. You'd be in a position where you might be in a group of riders and you'd think, well, I know I can beat five of these riders, but there are two guys that I can't beat here, or I think I might not be. So let's try and work out a financial deal here. And often the team managers would be involved in it. Money would exchange hands, and a deal would be done that way. And that buying and selling of races went on for years and years, and it probably still does to a certain extent. But I think it's a lot harder to do now because the sponsors are bigger. They're putting a lot more money into the sport. If you're a team manager now, you can't go to your sponsor and say, no, we haven't won anything this year, but look at all this money we made from selling all these races, because they're not going to be interested in that anymore.
That's kind of sad, isn't it, in a way?
I think that's one of the things that people love about cycling. It kind of, there's like an underhand side to it of like people trying to get one up on each other. And cycling is one of these, every sport's about sort of getting better of your rival. But in cycling, you've got so many rivals that it's often hard to play them all at the same time or hard to keep on track of who's going to be doing what. And I guess sort of paying a few people off was a way of helping teams do that.
Well, we talked about tactics not really changing much over the century, a little bit more than century, that cycling has been racing. How has technology changed it, though? Now we have race radios and power meters and all these technical assistants. Has that changed the peloton? Has that changed the way cyclists race?
I mean, it undoubtedly has. But, I mean, one of the things that I find quite interesting about all these, I mean, there was obviously a lot of debate about using race radios, about using power meters in races. I mean, even now about using disc brakes in races, which is still going on. And this kind of debate has been going on since the year dot. I mean, sort of back in the early part of the 20th century, it was all about whether riders should be allowed to use derailleurs. I mean, Henri de Grange, the tool founder, was very much against them. He thought they kind of corrupted the purity of racing because it allowed riders obviously change gear and kind of hide their strength or show their strength in certain parts of the race on climbs, for example. And he wanted everybody to race just on one gear or be able to flip a rear wheel over and race on two gears effectively because they have another sprocket.
Right.
He liked the purity of that kind of thing. And he kept the tour like that until until 1936 when he left as race director. But other races, they allowed derailleurs and riders began to use them. And we're still kind of having this debate about whether technology should be allowed, whether it's a good thing for the sport. I mean, I think the fundamental thing is that the kind of the genie's out of the bottle. All this stuff is being used. You can't kind of shove it back in. I don't think it's really going to help us in a massive way to suddenly say to people, when I spoke to TJ Van Garderen about this, and one of America's leading racers, stage racers, and he was saying, if they want to ban power meters, yeah, go ahead, but it'll make no difference to races because all the riders are riding with power meters all the time when they're training. They know what their numbers are. They get used to riding with a power meter. So even when they're in a race, if they have got a power meter, they'll know pretty much the amount of power that they're putting out, what other people are doing, when they can go into the red, when they shouldn't. And so it won't really change too much. I mean, race radios are a little bit different perhaps because riders are getting information, perhaps tactical information from their team managers behind them, and maybe they should be kind of allowed to think or made to think a bit more for themselves, giving an advantage to those riders who do have a strong tactical brain and can take advantage of that. I mean, that's all part of this ongoing debate we have.
Once again, I'm speaking with Peter Cozens about his new book, How the Race Was Won, Cycling's Brightest Minds Share Their Race Strategies. You know what? One of your chapters that's really, really interesting as the book unfolds is about women's racing and how it's different. It's less likely to predict a winner in a women's race than a men's race. Why is that?
It's interesting, actually. I mean, I would say that at the moment, I much prefer to watch women's racing than men's racing because you never really know what's going to happen. I mean, a lot of the time, there'll be the same people will win. It'll be Marianne Vos or Anna van Vleuten, who's won a big race in Holland today, Anna van der Breggen, Lizzie Deignan. You get the same names coming through, but often the racing will be very unpredictable. I spoke to Rachel Heal about this, she's a director sportif of the United Healthcare team in the States. And she works both with them, United Healthcare's men's team and with the women's team. And she says that one of the key differences is that when she's working on a men's race, you pretty much know what's going to happen at the start of a race. There's going to be a break will go away soon after the start. You can pretty much predict which teams are going to have riders in that break, who's then going to chase the break down, and then what the scenario will be with them. So you can kind of plan your strategy quite easily. Whereas with a women's race, she says it's much more difficult to work out what's going to happen because breaks will go, they'll come back, other breaks will go. And some of the strongest riders in the race will often be in those early breaks, so they won't be waiting and waiting like guys like Chris Froome and Romain Bardet do in the Tour de France until the last few kilometers. They'll go early because they're stronger. And I guess in a way that women's racing is perhaps a bit like men's racing was in the 1970s and 80s. I don't mean it's kind of backward, but in terms of like the lack of control that there is there, that riders, if you look at riders like Merckx and Eno back in those days, they would attack from a long way out. They would try and shake the race up. And it was exciting. And I guess one of the things that we're always doing with the Tour de France, that it's become so programmed in terms of and so predictable in terms of the racing that we want to go back to those days. And I think we can go back to those days by watching the women more and giving them more exposure.
I love that idea. That's a great idea. So do you think that today's racing will ever be, this is one of those weird questions, dope-free? I mean, I know that things are still happening. We had the big controversy over Chris Froome and his asthma medication. And, you know, it's just beyond me how they can't seem to get it under control. But what do you think? How is that part of the tactics of racing?
Well, doping is one of those things that I kind of deliberately, I almost wanted to avoid it completely when I was writing the book, because one of the reasons that, I say quite early on in the book, that having worked as a journalist in cycling for 25 years, I'd become pretty demoralized, I guess, would be I mean, I didn't have the same passion for the sport that I first did. Now, I mean, I guess that's the same with anybody in any profession, but doping was the main part of that. I mean, I don't honestly know what's going on in the sport now. I'm very hopeful that things have changed, that the situation isn't anywhere near as bad as it was a decade ago or 15 years ago, that things have improved. I mean, and I think kind of when you look at the racing, it sort of backs that up, that the riders are very much at the same level. They're all doing the same things training-wise. They're going to altitude. They're doing the same training programs. They're riding the same kind of cutting-edge equipment. And it's really hard to separate them. So I like to think that doping isn't having an effect, but I mean, it's impossible to say for sure. And you only have to look at other sports, athletics or winter sports or whatever, to see that there's still a massive issue with doping. And maybe cycling's gone through all the problems that the likes of athletics are dealing with now and to a certain extent come out the other side and things are better. But I mean, some people are always going to look to get an edge on the others. I mean, that's what sport's all about. And some people are going to try and find an underhand way of doing that.
Right. Well, the book is fascinating. And I think that for anybody who's interested in bicycle racing and the way it unfolds and how to deal with some of the things like how to bluff your rivals, how to win in the mountains, going downhill fast, all of those things are part of Peter's new book, How the Race Was Won, Cycling's Brightest Minds Share in Their Race Strategies. So the book, again, will be available November 12th here in the States. It's from Velo Press. I think it's a really good one. It's one you want to have on your shelf, I believe. I really like it. And I love the idea, bluffing, alliances that come together or dissolve in an instant, keep your rivals guessing. That's the best thing, right?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's all about playing poker, really. I mean, how you kind of, you know what's in your own hand, and you want all the other riders to show what's in their hand before you reveal what you've got. I mean, that's what cycling's all about. And I mean, that's one of the fascinating things about it. And one of the things I think that maybe that people have forgotten about, that it kind of has this beautiful kind of, I don't want to use the word underhand again because it's got a negative terminology, but it's just got this, maybe kind of slighter hand is a better way, that people are trying to pull the wool over each other's eyes, that they're trying to fool each other. And I mean, that's happening in other sports, but in cycling it's happening all the time. It's kind of fundamental to what cyclists are all about. They're trying to hide, every cyclist is trying to hide the strengths they've got and the weaknesses they've got, definitely, and trying to make sure or trying to encourage other riders to reveal what they've got in terms of strengths and weaknesses.
Well, the one last thing I want to talk about is Lawson Craddock. I assume that you followed him through the tour, as we all did.
Yeah, I was on the tour, so I witnessed his Calvary, I guess you'd call it. I mean, he's just the torture that he went through right from the very first day, I think it was, right to the finish, which is quite astounding to see.
And I think that he exemplifies what we all hope cycling can be, this sort of brave, hard, fast and furious sport. It's a really cool sport, and I really think he exemplified it. It was wonderful to watch him.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting because I've been reading some stuff about the guy who wore the first yellow jersey, called Eugene Christophe, a Frenchman, who very famously, his forks broke when he was coming down the Tourmalet in the 1913 Tour de France, and he carried his bike on his shoulder, and then he went to a forge, having sort of run 10 kilometers down the mountain to find a blacksmith's forge, and he spent 4 hours in there kind of fettling his bike and getting the forks fixed, and then set out again. And it's that kind of I guess it's that kind of heroic stuff that cycling's really all about. I mean, Lawson Craddock's story was another in that kind of long line of heroic performances, people kind of completely battling the odds and coming through. I mean, even though Lawson Craddock finished way, way back.
And dead last.
It didn't matter. I mean, the fact that he finished, the fact that he was there every day, and you could see that on the early stages, he was really struggling. And then as the race went on, I mean, I don't know whether his shoulder was getting better or he was getting stronger, he got used to it, but he wasn't falling off the back so quickly, and he was climbing a bit better than some of the other guys. It was just a great story, really uplifting. And the support that he got I mean, he was raising money to rebuild this velodrome in Texas.
Right.
And the support that he got personally, the money that he got for the velodrome is just astounding. I mean, people really respond to that kind of thing.
Right. And they're still raising money. In fact, he just, I think it was on Twitter yesterday, said, "I'm coming for you, Houston. Well, Peter, thank you so much for talking with me about the new book again, How the Race Was Won, Cycling's Top Minds Reveal the Road to Victory. Peter Cousins, he is the author of many cycling books. This one is the latest. You will be able to get it from Velo Press and all the usual places November 12th. Put it on your list if you're interested. I think you will be.
Many thanks, Diane.
All right. You take care of that cold.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye for now then, Diane. Bye.
Bye.
Peter Cousins joined me from his home in France. I apologize that the audio was a little iffy for this conversation. I hope you got the whole thing. How the Race Was Won will be available from Velo Press on November 12th if you're interested in having a copy on your shelf or thinking about it as a holiday gift. So thanks again to Lisa Mazzola from The Art of Cycling NYC for her time and conversation today. And thank you for listening. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or any of the podcast apps on your tablet or smartphone. You can follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet at Outspoken without an E. I'd like to also say thank you to all of you who took the time to show your support with your donations last week. You can hear more about that and find the link to our sponsor page at OutspokenCyclist.com. I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe out there. It's going to be busy with the holiday weekend. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.